Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is broadcasting live from the Mothership Air America headquarters in New York City. Flying home this afternoon, and boy, am I looking forward to seeing, again, Louise and Fang, our new cat, just got his, it's cut off yesterday, so he's our new kitten. Our new male kitten is now an it, but he seems to be handling it well, although Higgins is knocking him around, so I'm looking forward to seeing Fang and Higgins again. And, of course, it being Friday, brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, as he is every Friday. I think of you, Bernie, as America's senator, and this as America's town hall meeting. Welcome to the show, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's always great to have you here. By the way, sanders.senate.gov is Bernie's website. Our phone number, 866-303-2270. Bernie will be taking your calls right after the break. Bernie, thoughts on GM, thoughts on the bailouts, thoughts on the economy?
Well, I think the deep issue here, Tom, is the new reports, economic reports that came out today, tell us that we lost 533,000 jobs in November. That is the 11th consecutive monthly decline in terms of jobs. And unemployment now is officially at 6.7%, but if you include people who have given up looking for work, if you include underemployment, people who want to work full-time but who are working less than 40 hours a week, the numbers are really a lot higher than that. So we are now at the cusp of the most serious economic conditions that this country has faced since the Great Depression. You have millions of workers now who just are really at the end of their rope, just losing their jobs, don't know where to turn. You're finding older people who may have put some money into the stock market have seen that disappear and now are wondering how they're going to live out their remaining years with any kind of dignity. You're seeing families who have put money into the stock market, hopefully, so that their kids can go to college. That's gone. A lot of that is gone. So we have some major, major economic problems. And I think as a nation, we're going to have to start focusing on that issue, and we're going to have to start rethinking a lot of the paradigms that we've been operating under for many years that you and I have talked about. This whole right-wing ideology of tax breaks to billionaires somehow being good for the economy, the idea of anti-unionism, the idea of unfettered free trade, and opposition to living wage proposals. So we've got a lot on our on the table right now, and we have got to really be focusing on this.
Bernie, I have to share something with you that I found extraordinary, and I think you'll find it fascinating. Larry Beinhart was on the show earlier this week. He did an analysis from 1913 to today, 1913 when the income tax began. And what he found was that when the income tax on wealthy people, on people making in today's dollars over $3 million a year, when that top marginal rate was above about 70%, which was from 1913 to 1921, and from 1935 until 1980, when it was above that rate, that the economy grew steadily and solidly and relatively rapidly, and there were no major perturbations. On the other hand, every time that level of taxation on the very wealthy was rapidly dropped, the tax cuts, I think it was Coolidge, whoever was president in 2021, dropped it from 70% down to 25%. That led to the roaring 20s. He said every time that happens, you get a boom and bust cycle. Again, right. Reagan dropped it. You had a boom and bust, Black Monday of 1987. Bush dropped it, another boom and bust. Even when Clinton backed off on taxes toward the end of his term, you had the dot-com boom and bust. And so he said if you really want to stop the boom and bust cycle, roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
Well, I agree with that. And I also agree that we have to start a real conversation about the issue of greed in our society. We are where we are today in terms of this horrendous financial bailout, unprecedented in American history. We're talking about $7 or $8 trillion being placed at risk because of the greed of a very small number of people playing with exotic financial instruments that nobody in the world understands. Year after year, these hedge funds were making 30, 40% rates of return. Not good enough for them. They pushed the envelope. They took us to the edge. And we're now paying an enormously heavy price for that. And that talks to the whole issue of deregulation. But what you're talking about is that moving toward a more egalitarian society where you don't have the richest 1% earning more income than the bottom 50% is not only morally the right thing to do, which I believe it is, but it is also economically the right thing to do, that long term you cannot have a sustainable economy where so few have so much and so many have so little.
Right. Yeah. And actually, we have the proof now.
Pardon me?
And now we have the proof. I mean, this guy actually.
We do. We have got to, so right now, let me just mention to the listeners that, one of the areas we're going to be focusing on big time, of course, is this financial bailout. I am active in saying we're not going to provide another $350 billion to Wall Street without the proactive assent of Congress. We're not going to just simply let it happen. Deep, deep concerns about how this first $350 billion has been spent, which I strongly opposed. I voted against it. Second of all, we have to move as aggressively and as quickly as possible for a major economic recovery package, which begins the process of rebuilding America and putting people to work. And that means massive investments in our decaying infrastructure, into public transportation, into energy independence, breaking our dependency on foreign fuel, moving to lower greenhouse gas emissions by energy efficiency. That means putting a whole lot of money into weatherization projects. All over America, you have older buildings which are just terribly inefficient, wasting energy every single day, inadequate roofs, windows, insulation. We've got to address that issue. We are sitting at the cusp of a revolution in terms of solar, in wind, geothermal, biomass. We've got to move aggressively, and we create jobs as we do that as well. And in the midst of all of this, we have to make sure that those people who are hurting, those people who have lost their jobs, those people who are hungry, are also provided for. So we have a lot of work in front of us, but I think this is the moment in American history where we really start thinking, rethinking this Reaganomics, this right-wing economic theory, which has done so much damage to our country.
It truly has, Bernie. What are your thoughts on what's going ahead with GM and Chrysler?
Well, here's what I think. I think we're caught in a rut between a rock and a hard place. You and I have talked very often about the decline of manufacturing in this country. And that is not just that when people go Christmas shopping, it's hard to find a product made in the United States, but that's true for even military equipment as well. So I think, one hand, you cannot allow the automobile industry to fall apart with the result of the loss of millions of good-paying jobs and the decline or the elimination of a significant part of manufacturing in America. I think, especially at this moment, that would be a disaster. On the other hand, simply to pour money into the incompetent hands of the leadership that we have in Detroit right now and do the same old, despite some rhetoric, certainly does not make any sense to me at all. So how you save automobile manufacturing in America, how you restructure that industry, I think you probably got to get rid of the current leadership there who have been just absolutely reactionary at every turn. And how you create a policy which revitalizes that industry so that they're producing the kinds of fuel-efficient cars and buses that we need, how you make sure that they are not shipping our jobs, continue to ship our jobs to China and so forth. Those are the challenges that we face.
Are we going to see that kind of leadership out of this Congress, do you think?
Well, you'll see more leadership than you did have in the past. But I am not impressed when I hear these guys, you know, the industry coming forward and boasting about how they're restructuring by laying off tens and tens of thousands of workers. What's the point? The point is to create jobs, not to lay off workers. Obviously, you want an efficient operation. But I think we're gonna need a lot more bold leadership in terms of manufacturing in America, in terms of the automobile industry than we're currently seeing. I mean, this is not easy stuff, and we should be clear about that. But I'm not impressed by the current group of leaders that we have.
Yeah, I think we have. Well, we'll see. We'll see. It's going to take, as you say so often, it's going to take all of us. It's going to take we the people getting out there and getting active.
Right.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders, our phone lines were down a little earlier, so if you try and called and couldn't get through, try again. I think they're working, are they? 866-303-2270? Yes or no? Give it a try. Let's see if you can get through. Oh, my. Tom Hartman here with you. Sanders.Senate.gov is Bernie's website as well. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. You can get more information at Teamster, singular, Teamster.org. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, as it is every Friday, has been for years and years. Senator Bernie Sanders, neither a Democrat nor a Republican, the independent from Vermont. Bernie, our phone lines are extremely flaky. We have recently changed phone providers. We've got two callers up right now. I just called our own 800 number, and I got a busy signal, even though I've got nine empty lines. So we'll take a couple of calls, and people keep trying to call and trying to get in, because some people are getting through, but not everybody. And Bernie, you and I may be having a little longer conversation. But right now, Max in Los Angeles is on the line with a question or comment for you. Max, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning. Ever since Ronald Reagan, the idea of any sort of government spending has been portrayed as absolute waste and pork barrel garbage for the most part. And I believe in the next couple of years, spending is needed. And I think it's going to be very, very important for the administration and this Congress to make it clear to people what they are getting for this spending.
Yes.
And to show people that, you know what, this is not waste. And I think it's to me, it's a basic concept that people should understand this, but the right has successfully portrayed it all as, pork barrel waste. And I think it's really important that
Max makes a very, very good point. We hear every time that a dollar of federal funding is misspent, it ends up on the front pages of the papers, and it should. But every time that we have successful programs out there that are working really well and efficiently, we hear very little about them. So I think Max's point is right in two respects. Number one, if we are going to start stimulating the economy, if we're going to start creating good-paying jobs, if we're going to start addressing the unmet needs of the American people, which are rather enormous, whether it is infrastructure, whether it is healthcare, whether it's sustainable energy, whether it is education, that's going to require a very substantial investment. And it does two things. It creates jobs. It addresses unmet needs. And Max's point is also right in the sense that there are a lot of very good federal programs out there, and people literally don't even know that they're federal programs. Let me give you just one example where we have been very active on. Amidst all of the crises within healthcare, where we have 47 million uninsured and even more underinsured, we pay by far more per capita for healthcare than any other country on earth, there is a federal program called the Federally Qualified Community Health Centers. They exist in every state in the union. Many people have driven past them. Many listeners have gone into them. Many people don't even know that these are primarily, not totally, federally funded programs that are perhaps the most cost-effective healthcare in the United States, providing excellent primary healthcare dental care, mental health counseling, low-cost prescription drugs, and we want to expand that program very substantially because it works so well. But many of the people who use that program don't even know that this is federal dollars coming in to provide excellent quality primary health care. Many other examples of that. But I think what we need to do is we need citizen, active citizen participation to make sure that these federal programs are done cost effectively, that they accomplish the goals that they set out to address, and that we work together to make sure that they work as well as they possibly can.
Bernie, I know you know how important language is. You're a student of it. I just wrote a book about language in the political sphere. How about if we stopped using the word spending and started using the word investing whenever we talk about these
Tom, things? Yes. I mean, I think that's let me give you I give you a profound example of this. In the United States today, and we don't talk about this very often, about 18% of our children under 18 live in poverty. This is far and away the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. Now, when we talk about investment, what does this mean? We're not investing in our kids so that you have millions of kids who by the time they're in the sixth grade are intellectually dropping out. By the time they're in high school, they drop out of school. They end up doing drugs. They end up doing petty crime. They get into trouble. Here's the point. Instead of investing in child care, instead of making sure that these kids do well in school, which requires a substantial investment, we don't do that. They drop out. They get in trouble. And you know what? They end up in jail. We have some 3 million people in jail in the United States. That's more than China has, more than any other country. We spend about $50,000 a head to keep somebody in jail. Now, in terms of investment, does it make more sense to make sure that these kids stay in school, do well, become taxpaying workers, or should we lock them up at $50,000 a head? That's an issue of investment. Preventative health care, the same thing. We have 56 million Americans who can't access a doctor. They end up getting sicker. 20,000 people a year die because they don't have health insurance. But when people need help, where do they go? They go to the emergency room. They go to the hospital. We end up spending far more than we should if we had a strong investment in primary health care. So your point is absolutely right. What many other countries understand, it makes more sense, both in terms of dollars and in terms of human suffering, to invest up front, protect children, make sure that people have access to health care, than at the other side of the equation, putting people in jail when they fail in life or when they get sick.
Right, which is then an expense. That is spending.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's stupid spending. So
and
we
it's
should,
an avoidable expense.
Right, so we should be investing in everything from our children to our schools and our hospitals.
And our environment.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie hour. We've got a couple of phone lines working, so, and we've got a couple of calls on the board. We'll be picking them up right after the break here, 866-303-2270. Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Well, I'm still in Tulsa, Texas, just asking any bar. Although I screwed the country, they still think I'm a star. Here neighbors trust their neighbors, that's why I tap their phones. It keeps their freedom ringing, and I feel less alone. Even though I love them, that's just where I'm at. Besides, rumor has it that one's a Democrat. Let's go to Mars.
George has the greatest ideas, doesn't he? Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We have rebooted our phone system. Everything is working once again here in the Starship Enterprise. And Bernie, you're still here with us?
I'm still here.
Baruch Hashem. Thank God. Okay, let's take some phone calls here. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. I hope Barack isn't fake hope. Bernie, Michael Moore said it best, why pay them, or the cost of a car is 50% labor, or 50% parts, 10% labor, and 40% white collar. Michael Moore said it best recently, why pay them all those billions of dollars when the stock is so low we could buy them outright for $3 billion, and it would... I don't. What's your input on that?
Well, it's an issue that we are thinking about. Actually, I think later on this afternoon I'm going to be on the phone with a number of economists to talk just this issue. What Michael Moore is saying makes sense, but there's another side to the story, and that it's not just buying the stock. When you buy the stock and control the company, you're also inheriting a lot of the liabilities. In that you're picking up a lot of liabilities, which are very, very, very expensive. But it is the what role the government should play other than simply giving incompetent leadership a bridge loan. And clearly, you know, they already told us they went from 25 to 34 billion in a couple of weeks. There are people who think they're going to need a lot more than that. So just throwing good money after bad does not make any sense. I don't think, frankly, the government is going to be effectively running the automobile industry, but Moore makes an important point. How does the taxpayer get best value in restructuring the industry, producing the products that we need, and protecting jobs? And that is precisely the paradigm with which we're trying to figure out a solution.
Ruby in Chandler, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. There's one thought that we're missing here, which is we keep talking about production and how we have to build and build and build the economy to, like, save us out of this. But Tom always talks about when we produce things, we build wealth. I would submit to you that when we repair the natural capital that underlies our systems of production, we are also creating wealth. And we have to be really careful that we don't throw the natural world right onto the fire while trying to burn ourselves out of this mess.
I think you make a good point. A good friend of mine, Bill McKibben, who's actually lives in Middlebury, Vermont. Tom, you know Bill, don't you?
I do. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Great guy. He's written a book called Deep Economy, which I think begins to touch on some of these issues. It's not just, if the caller is suggesting that the long-term answer is not just building more and more crap, for example, designed to break down in a couple of years and coming up with something else and destroying the environment, long-term, that is not the solution. What we really need to do is figure out what sustainability means, how we provide wealth for all of the people, but does not necessarily mean just building and building and building. And that's pretty radical stuff, but I think that's the kind of thought process we need to inject into this whole discussion. It's not just the growth of the GMP. It's creating meaningful jobs. It's protecting the environment. It's making sure that everybody in our society has the health care, the education, the other basic affordable housing and the other basic necessities that human beings need. And to understand that very often, especially under Reaganomics, you have substantial, and we saw this early in Bush's tenure, you had substantial economic growth, but the middle class continued to shrink and poverty grew wider. So almost all of the benefits of that growth went to the top 1%. So how do you create a society where everybody benefits from economic activity and not just the people on top?
Yep. Amen. Kevin in Miami, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Kevin, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, good afternoon, actually. Yeah, I was given a call about the bailout and how it's been proceeding. I don't understand why so much money is being given to Wall Street and other companies such as AIG and Citibank and what have you, and no money is being given to people who got caught up in these loans, whether through their fault or whether not through their fault. But it seems like all this money, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars is going to bail out these other companies, but no money is being given to the people who really need the help.
And well, Kevin, a very important issue. And it is one that is being increasingly discussed. I think that there is, I voted against this bailout for a dozen different reasons. But the point that Kevin is making, and Kevin, it's not just hundreds of billions of dollars. We're now talking between the loans of the Federal Reserve plus what the Treasury is spending. We're talking about $6-8 trillion. And one of the scandals involved is, especially through the Fed, we don't even know where this to whom this money is being lent. We don't know the terms of those transactions. A lot of secrecy, and I think it's widely understood that oversight has been, at best, very poor. And Kevin raises the question, is we're bailing out these big guys, what about people who are about to be losing their homes? And I think he raises a right issue, and I think you're even hearing Bernanke of the Fed talk about that. So I think, Kevin, you are going to see increased attention on that.
Mike in Kalamazoo, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. The reason I'm calling is I don't hear anyone talking about the things Kucinich has mentioned, like the hole that we're in. You know, we're talking 7 or 8 trillion right now, right?
Yes.
Well, the hole is actually closer to 650 trillion, and nobody's talking about it.
Where are you getting that from?
Dennis Kucinich and a lot of other
experts
to talk about these credit default swaps.
Right. What I think Mike is talking about, Tom, is one of the horrors that we have got to deal with again. If, you know, I have said over and over again, if an institution is too big to fail, it's too big to exist. In other words, we have created these institutions like AIG and these major financial institutions, and then what happens when they're tottering, they come running to Congress and say, if we fail, the whole economy goes with us, you have to bail it out.
Right.
Now, the other side of that is if you have institutions that are too complicated to understand, you know what? They shouldn't exist either. So what Mike is talking about is the fact that there are, we think, I haven't heard hundreds of trillions. I don't know exactly what that.
Yeah, no, the Bank of International Settlements said that the total credit default swap and other derivatives market last year was a little over $600 trillion.
Well, which is a number that means nothing to anybody. Who could even fathom what
that? It's 10 times the GDP of the entire planet.
Right. I mean, so what does that mean? But I think what Kucinich and a few other people are talking about is there is, in essence, a shadow economy out there.
Mm.
That is completely unregulated, where very, very small numbers of people are playing with extraordinarily large sums of money. And that is totally inappropriate in a democratic society. So you could look at the economy in one hand that we discuss as one thing. Then you look at the shadow economy. Who even knows what's going on? How many people know what a credit default swap is? And then you talk about trillions or tens of trillions or hundreds of trillions. Nobody knows what that means. And that is a very, very dangerous situation. It should not be allowed to exist. I mean, I think maybe it's a time, a previous caller raised this, about, you know, rethinking a lot of basic economic issues, whether we think it is a great idea for trillions and trillions of dollars to be floating out there, controlled by people who we don't know, doing it in the shadows. Does this make really a whole lot of sense? I think not. And maybe we better just become a little bit more conservative. I would point out that in my own small state of Vermont, the banks are doing fairly well. They're not having any great crisis. You know why? They lend out money to people whom they know, to businesses whom they know. Actually, they're doing fairly well. And maybe some by credit unions are doing fairly well. And you know what else, Tom? This bailout, we should remember, is not the first. I mean, it's far bigger than anything that we can remember. But when I first came into Congress, you know what the issue of discussion was? Savings and loan bailout. You had a bunch of reckless guys who were running the savings and loan, investing in all kinds of real estate, pushing the edge, making huge profits, and then suddenly the bubble burst. And you had the Mexican peso bailout. And then you had the whole Asian financial crisis. Over and over again, what we see is a lot of these financial guys just stretching the envelope, trying to make that last extra buck, and then bringing us to the precipice. And then these lovely guys who believe in unfettered free enterprise run to the federal government, run to the middle class, and they say, hey, we made a little bit of a mistake. The world is collapsing. Bail us out. Maybe that's the type of economics we should start rethinking.
Yeah, and each one of those crashes was preceded by a major round of deregulation. Deregulating
Absolutely.
The SNLs. In the Asian economies, they were listening to the Chicago School guys, and they embraced, Milton Friedmanism with their economic policies, monetarism, right across the board. Every single one of these times, it's like, you know, we get out of the way and or we stop.
And then they make a fool. fortune until they collapse and they come to the middle class for a bailout.
That's right. Yeah. And they keep their fortune, by the way.
That's right.
Something really wrong with this. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders.Senate.gov, Bernie's website. You want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com for our free live video stream. Maybe Ron Hartenbaum will come over and wave in front of the camera. I don't know. He's in the studio here with us. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Brain! It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Does not lead to stiff thinking, however. 9.5 minutes before the hour, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us on the line. And Bernie, you are still there? Bernie? I'm not hearing Bernie. I just put him on, but I'm not hearing him. Hello? No, I'm not hearing him, Steffi. Maybe he got disconnected? Okay. We're gonna try and get Bernie back on. And in the meantime, we'll pick up a phone call here. Nora in Minneapolis. Hey, Nora, you had something you wanted to say to Bernie? And I will pass it along when we get him back on the line. But you are on the air. Oh, we're not hearing Nora either. Stephanie? Okay, let's just try Drew in Monterey, California. Hey, Drew, are you there? Can you hear me, Drew? Now, I think we have had a meltdown in our telephone system. So, hi. It looks like Bernie's on the board. It looks like people are on the board. I'm not hearing any of it. Bernie?
Hello.
Hey, Bernie. Yes, I can hear you. Today. It's the Punch and Judy show today, Bernie.
All right. I'm on the cell phone, so I don't know how well that works. But...
Okay. Yeah, no, it works just fine. And okay. Drew in Monterey, are you on the line? Can you hear us? No? Let's try Jim in Detroit. Jim, can you hear us? That side of the phone board does not seem to be working. So, Bernie, let's just you and I are going to have to wrap this hour up here together. One of the things that I found really fascinating, an article in, I'm forgetting the magazine now, but anyway, it was last month's issue, was this whole idea that because starting in the 1980s, we began compensating executives, CEOs, with stock rather than pay, they started behaving as if they were stockholders rather than as if they cared about the company. And stockholders, of course, are interested in short-term profits, whereas historically, you know, a CEO was somebody who was with a company 30, 40 years, and they cared about the length of the company. And so we should, this article was suggesting, we should quit giving CEOs and senior executives pay stock and have them stop behaving like stockholders and start behaving like managers interested in the interests of the company. And I think this is what's happened with the big three. These guys have been looking at quarterly profit statements and things rather than anything else. What are your thoughts on that? Bernie? Have we lost? There's something wrong with all the phones in the studio. We've lost Bernie again, too. Okay, well, I'll just tell you, that's my rant. And I think that this is a real issue, that there are three players at the table in a publicly traded company. You have the workers, number one. You have the management, number two, which is really the corporation. And number three, you have the stockholders. Now, stockholders are not owners. And having the stockholders, having the management traditionally would do things like say, you know, we're going to build this company over the long term. Like Toyota and Honda, you know, they were building small cars even when it wasn't fashionable, even when it wasn't necessary, even when it wasn't useful, even when there was no market for it. Bernie, are you back with us?
I am kind of back with you on my cell phone.
Okay.
It's a rough day technologically here.
It is. It's like, you know, the stars are crossed or something. I don't know what's going on. But anyhow, anything on your mind, Bernie, you want to riff on?
I think the bottom line here, Tom, is we've been discussing, and as many of the listeners know, these are enormously difficult and complex economic times. And we're going to have to work together. If the problem is that too few people have too much economic power and political power, and most people have neither, we're going to have to reverse that equation. And we need to do a lot of thinking and a lot of political activism to figure out how we create an economy that works for everybody and is not this boom and bust type of economy that we're currently experiencing. So a lot of work in front of us, and I just hope people will be thinking about these issues and working with Congress to make some very fundamental changes.
Bernie, I'm concerned that Barack Obama is the national Rorschach test, that everybody has been reading into him what their best hopes are, or in some cases their worst fears, and that, you know, he's going to actually have to start legislating, and it's going to just disappoint a few people, and I don't want the movement that has formed around him to go away. In fact, I'd like, you know, you and I and progressives to capture that movement and keep those energized young people. How do we do that?
Well, I think how we do it is, to my mind, I've said this many times, the most exciting aspect of Obama's campaign was not just his ideas and his message of hope, which is very important, but his ability to mobilize millions and millions of people, especially young people and working people, to get involved in the political process. And you're absolutely right, Tom, that if we lose that involvement, what real reform, whether it's healthcare, the economy, the environment, is going to be met with enormous opposition from very well-entrenched, powerful special interests. And it's going to take a mass movement working with the Congress, with President Obama, to get anything done. So we're going to have to maintain and strengthen grassroots activism if we're going to accomplish anything significant.
Right. So, for example, you know, I travel around the country. We invite people to meetings. You do a lot of town hall things. We encourage people to join organizations, democracyforamerica.com, moveon.org, things like that.
Absolutely. And I think people at the grassroots level should accelerate their contact with members of the House and with the Senate. Town meetings are a very good vehicle to do that. Invite your member of the House. Invite your senator. Make sure you have hundreds of people there. Be clear about what you want. Let's figure out what the progressive agenda is, what makes sense, and throw those issues out to your elected officials and let them tell you where they're coming from. We've got to do a better job in paying attention to when Nathan votes come up as well. We can, you know, put pressure on our elected officials.
Yep, very well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, Bernie, I apologize for our technical problems today and to all our listeners, but thank you so much for being with us, Bernie.
Thank you.
Sanders.senate.gov, Bernie's website. He's got a great newsletter there. Sign up for it. TomHartman.com for our live chat room. AirAmerica.com. We'll try 866-303-2270. Right back with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Lamar Waldron is on the line with us. He is the author. I am the very, very secondary co-author of a new book called Legacy of Secrecy: Robert Kennedy, National Security, the Mafia, and the assassination of Martin Luther King. Actually, the long shadow of the JFK assassination, I believe, is the official subtitle, Lamar.
That's correct, Tom.
And welcome to the program.
Great to be back and great to be talking to you after we worked together on this for about 20 years at this point.
It has been that long, hasn't it?
Yes, it has been.
This is the sequel book to our book, Ultimate Sacrifice, in which we laid out who killed John Kennedy, how and why. You in particular are laying out, you did so much of the work on this, who killed Martin Luther King, how and why. And by the way, the Discovery Channel hour-long special that NBC did out of our book, Ultimate Sacrifice, is that running this week?
Not this week that I know of. It runs occasionally both on the Discovery Channel and on a couple of the other Discovery Channels that they have. But people can, the name of the show is Conspiracy Files JFK Assassination.
Okay, because my...
So they can Google that and find the next time that it will be on.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. My show notes here say it reruns at 11 a.m. and I was off a bit here. So let's get right to the issues of this new book.
Sure.
Number one. The assassination of John Kennedy began a series of frantic activities within and without our government that indirectly led to the assassination of Martin Luther King. Fair to say?
That's correct. The central essence of the book is that all the government secrecy surrounding President Kennedy's murder allowed three confessed conspirators, one of those confessions and legacy for the first time, allowed three confessed conspirators to not only later help murder Martin Luther King, but it even impacts other things today, like our current almost 50-year impasse with Cuba. And it even perhaps contributed to Robert Kennedy's murder as well. So the theme of the book is just how all that government secrecy in the wake of President Kennedy's murder, some of which was legitimate to prevent World War III, others were just to hide intelligence failures and protect reputations. All that secrecy has just had a horrible effect then, again in 1968, and it continues with Cuba and other matters today.
Now, one of these three conspirators confessed in prison. The FBI had it on tape to the assassination of Kennedy, and you know everybody pretty much knew he was, I think by that time, that he was clearly involved in this. Why was that kept secret?
Well, again, let me be very careful to clarify here, because people should know that what's in the book is largely based on what two dozen associates of John and Robert Kennedy told us, plus thousands of documents that they frankly helped lead us to in the National Archives. And just to be specific,
including several people who had never before spoken with any researchers on this topic, and Harry Williams, one guy who everybody thought he had just vanished from the face of the earth, and we tracked him down.
Yeah, because he was a Cuban exile who moved to the snowy mountains of Colorado so that he wouldn't die the way so many of his associates died or suddenly committed suicide back in the 70s. Yeah. But let me clarify on that Marcello confession. So there are hundreds of hours of tapes of Marcello in prison in 1985, secretly recorded by the federal government in a secret little transistor radio in Marcello's jail cell that he was finally in prison for a long stretch in 85. And apparently on those tapes, Marcello does talk about a lot of his crimes to that same informant in front of a witness. He talked about meeting Lee Harvey Oswald, Marcello, the godfather of Louisiana, Texas, whose influence stretched all the way to Memphis, talked about setting Jack Ruby up in business, getting regular visits from Ruby. But the clearest confession to JFK's murder was actually made in the prison yard to this reliable FBI informant in front of a witness. And it's just remarkable where he just admits and says that he ordered JFK's murder. Yeah, I had the SOB killed, speaking of JFK, and I would do it again. He was a thorn in my side. I wish I could have done it myself. Now, all of these files and the hundreds of hours of tapes of Marcello talking about his crimes, that's been kept secret for 20 years. We have that right out of the National Archives in the book. And when you ask why it was kept secret, I think at that time it was kept secret by the high officials in Washington, not the FBI agents and supervisors. They talked to us. They would have had no problem seeing this get out. But it could have been embarrassing to high officials then. And the central core of our book, Legacy of Secrecy, that builds on Ultimate Sacrifice, the first one, is that there was a thin shred of national security that let officials hide embarrassing information in 1985, back in the mid-70s, when Rumsfeld and Cheney were the two top White House officials for then-President Gerald Ford, former Warren Commissioner.
Burying this stuff. So, and legacyofsecrecy.com, by the way, the website. We're talking with Lamar Waldron. Lamar and I have a new book out called Legacy of Secrecy. And Lamar, talk for a moment about how the – let's shift gears here for a moment to the assassination of Martin Luther King, which is a large part of the second book, and how the racists in Georgia, and you and I started on this book when I was living in Atlanta, you still do, How there, this small group of right-wing racists led to the assassination of King, and how we're seeing many echoes of that same thing right now in the plots against Barack Obama. You know, God forbid anything should ever happen to him.
It's just so tragic because Obama embodies so much of what the optimism and hope people felt in the 60s for President Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. And there has been an outpouring of racist incidents in the run-up to his election and since his election, including two actual assassination plots that bear startling similarities to plots that we describe in Legacy of Secrecy. And we saw the echoes in this Georgia Senate runoff, where the race card was played, and it was played hard, and not just the U.S. Senator, but some of our other congressmen, I'm ashamed to say, were basically calling Obama a Marxist and a communist. And these things we describe in Legacy of Secrecy, where it was that same climate of racism.
All right, we were writing this stuff a year ago, by the way, that now is being repeated. Pardon my interrupting you.
Exactly right. But the point is, you know, back in the 60s, politicians and large companies, for that matter, were using racism as a way to make money and gain political power. That created a climate that four racists here in Georgia in particular exploited, hitting up Atlanta's highest paid factory workers every Friday for money to fight civil rights. Now, if you were a regular contributor, they would, you know, whisper to you that, hey, this money is really going to kill Martin Luther King. In actuality, they were buying up a lot of mountain land up in North Carolina. So it was racist bilking other racists. But eventually those regular contributors got tired of seeing no action. So this one racist in particular from Georgia named Joseph Miltier, who had been investigated, by the way, for JFK's murder before JFK's death. The FBI had botched that investigation. And so Miltier was free 5 years later to pursue the murder of Martin Luther King. He tried to find a hitman on his own, was unable to. So Miltier turned to his old associate from 1963 in the JFK assassination, Carlos Marcello. And according to a Justice Department memo withheld from Congress, Miltier eventually was able to get Carlos Marcello to broker the assassination of Martin Luther King. And James Earl Ray was simply a low-level heroin runner for King, who then became...
Not for King, for Marcello.
Right. For Carlos Marcello. So you had this low-level heroin runner for Marcello, James Earl Ray, who became a hitman. And that explains why Ray came back to Atlanta on his way to Canada after killing King. And it's just a very sad story because the racist climate that Miltier and his buddies took advantage of when they were bilking those highly paid factory workers here in Atlanta, you know, was spawned by people in the 60s like Lester Maddox.
Yeah, who I live just eight blocks from. I would see at the bank. I mean, you know, it was so weird. And he had these big signs out in front of his house all the time, you know, of how the communists are trying to take over America.
Oh, it's just amazing. And then when we hear a Georgia politician who makes frankly racist appeals.
Saxby Chambliss doing this right now.
Well, Saxby and one of our other congressmen, and when they're basically calling Obama a Marxist and a communist, comparing him to Hitler, that's right out of the playbook from the 60s. And what I think those people don't realize is, people like Chambliss and our other congresspeople down here, the ones that were playing the race card, is just what a tinderbox America is. I mean, we've all seen the statistics and the stories about gun sales that have exploded since Obama's election. And, you know, so when you have people like a Wallace or a Maddox in the 60s or a Chambliss today exploiting that, it can have a terrible outcome. And that's why we want to drag all this to light and expose it, frankly.
Yeah, and we're doing it. The book is Legacy of Secrecy, the website legacyofsecrecy.com, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination, Robert Kennedy, National Security, the Mafia, and the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Lamar Waldron, and Tom Hartman, the authors. Lamar, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here. And by the way, people can...
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes. good authors too, who once knew better words, now only use forever words, writing prose. Anything goes.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's find out if our phones are still working here. Vernon in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Vernon, what's up?
Hey, Tom, long time listener, first time caller.
Well, thank you for calling.
I wanted to comment on the Jack Kennedy assassination.
Sure.
I've done a little bit of research, not a whole lot, but the one person nobody seems to mention in the whole assassination is Aristotle Onassis. And it's my belief that he is the one that kind of kick-started the whole or got the ball rolling on the both assassinations, Jack and Bobby.
No. Sorry, Vernon. He wasn't. He had nothing to do with it, and it's just not the case. It's an interesting theory. I mean, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there. But I recommend you check out our books, Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, because we just lay it all out. And the NBC special, the hour-long special that NBC did on our first book is also available on YouTube, apparently. I'm not quite sure how to find it, but I would guess if you were to Google it, you could track it down. Logan in Ojai, California. Hey, Logan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's an honor to speak with you.
Thanks.
I wanted to talk to you about the mortgage crisis and how it's been affecting me. I'm 27 years old. I own my own business. I build custom cabinetry. And I'm an only employee, and I bought a house at peak market. And everything was going great at that time. Everybody was taking out lines of credit. Business was great. As it's plummeted, so has work. Anyways, I found a solution to my problem, and I was able to do a buyout with my second. They took 10 cents on the dollar. In order to get the money, I just stopped paying my first. I didn't pay my first for 3 months. I got the money to pay my second. The deal is just about to close. My first is now going to foreclose on me because I'm behind. When I called them and told them at the end of December, I can give them $3,700, which is $1,500 over 1 month's mortgage. And in January and February, I'll give them $2,800, which is $600 more each month, which will bring me 2 months current, which is beyond foreclosure risk. They said, we will not do that for you. You need to give us the $3,700 down and $3,100 a month. I said, that's more than I'm paying with my first and my second at the moment. And they said, that's the only thing that we will do to work with you. And they're unwilling to do anything. And this is one of the companies that was bailed out. And this is how they're treating somebody that has a completely salvageable mortgage. I got rid of my second, saving me $900 a month, right. And they're not going to give me 3 months to get caught up.
Yeah, but if Robert Rubin comes to town, they'll give him $30 million or $30 billion, $30,000 million, and he gets to keep, by the way, the tens of millions of dollars in compensation he's gotten for being such a financial genius. Running Citicorp and back when he was the Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton. Logan, you have so identified the problem that these people don't give a damn. They don't give a rat's ass about what's going on with the average person in America, but they do, you know, but they are going to absolutely cover any problem that has to do with anything with regard to the wealthy bankers. I mean, it's just so wrong. Corrine in Laguna Beach. Hey, Corrine.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I had a comment about the loans for the major three automakers.
And Corrine, if I may interrupt you just for a minute,
yes.
Please forgive my I don't know if it was an illegal obscenity that I just used on the air. I'm pretty sure it wasn't, but it
rat's
it was,
ass, no.
Yeah, it was probably over the top, and so
I don't think
my apologies. Okay,
it could be a rat donkey.
There you go. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
The FCC won't get you. Anyway, my comment was that I believe that instead of just giving these companies, even the banks, money or even the loans that it would be for the automakers, I believe that we should be buying these institutions. And because we can buy them, they're worth next to nothing.
Right.
So instead of giving all these billions of dollars, we should be buying them.
Yeah, this is what France did with Peugeot years ago.
Yeah, and also Sweden did it with the banks, and then they offered them back to the public.
Yep.
After they got them straight.
Yep.
And that way we're not throwing away our money. We are actually investing, and it's ours. And we control what they do, what their CEOs make. We can decide what they are going to make, like better cars, greener cars. We can create more jobs. why are we just throwing away our money? Is it just because of corruption, political corruption?
It's because of Republicans. And I don't say that like, you know, some glib comment. Actually, I should say it's because of conservatives. It's because there is this pervasive belief among every Republican member of Congress and probably 30% of the Democrats that to do such a thing as socialism, that the government should never, ever step into owning a business in the private sector. And, you know, I think most of us, most Americans agree that broadly speaking, we don't want the government making our shoes, our cars, our TVs or anything else, you know, but we do want the government to run, you know, the police and the fire and the schools. But there, it has reached the point, it's been elevated to essentially to a religion. It's an irrational belief system. And so when you come along and say, why don't we do something common sense like the French did with Peugeot or like the Swedish did with their banks, these guys, they freak out. It's as if you had uttered a blasphemy, you know, and they just can't handle it.
To Bernie Sanders, though, I wanted to make that comment to him so maybe we could get some
action. Oh, he's already heard it, and he's, you know, he's very, very familiar with that. And the problem is there's just this political reality. The Republicans would never let this thing get through this Congress, and odds are the next Congress it would never get through that one either. But it's the common sense to do thing, Corrine, you're absolutely right. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes Friday, and boy, anything is going in Washington State, by the way. I just wanted to share this with you. Bill O'Reilly, of course, going hysterical about this. Bill O the Clown, because it's the war on Christmas, don't you know? There's a certain kind of, well, you know, this is what you get when you do it piece to this thing. You know, I don't know quite how to describe it beyond that. But there's a story on this, and I just lost it. Here it is. It's from the Spokesman Review that lays out the background. This is the atheist sign at the Capitol in Washington State, Olympia, Washington. And, you know, first the state was saying, okay, we're going to have a tree. You know, we've always had a tree, but we understand there's people who are not Christians and who are, you know, who say, you know, this is you're promoting one religion over the other. So we're going to call it a holiday tree. Because really, you know, the burning of the tree goes back to, like, pagan European times. Back thousands of years ago, the shaman, you know, on the shortest day of the year, December 23rd, you know, the winter solstice, the days were getting shorter and shorter, and the people were going, oh, no, the sun is going to go out. What are we going to do? It's going to get colder and colder, and we're all going to die. And the shaman would say, don't worry, don't worry. And, you know, he'd have one of those Stonehenge kind of little calendar things, and he'd see, okay, the winter solstice is just tomorrow, or the day after. So he'd go and he'd find the highest tree on the highest mountain, and he'd light that sucker. You know, pine trees burn really well if they're kind of dry. And he'd just light that thing up, and he'd say, I command the sun to return! And the next day, the day would be a little bit longer, and then the day after that, the day would be a little longer, and the day after that, and the days would get longer and longer, and all the people would say, he did it again. And thus the tradition of lighting a tree in the winter. It's an old Northern European pagan thing that had, you know, long before Jesus was even born. Long before, you know, probably long before Moses was born. So anyhow, the state, you know, in Washington, they said, you know, there's this long tradition about having a tree. So we're going to call this thing the holiday tree. Well, that didn't satisfy a Republican crazy, State Representative John Ahern, who said, nope, sorry, this is a Christmas tree, and in fact, I'm going to put a sign on it that says Merry Christmas. I will not tolerate this being called a holiday tree. So he puts up a sign that says Merry Christmas, and it's got a cross and a Star of David on it. So that is followed by a local rabbi suing and saying, hey, wait a minute, if you're going to have, you know, Merry Christmas on the tree, then you got to have a menorah at the very least. There's got to be something for, you know, for our holiday. And so that got put up. And so then the atheists came along and said, hey, wait a minute, if you guys are going to be promoting religious holidays, then you've got to promote our religion, atheism. And so, you know, the state said, okay, guess we'll do it. You know, what can we do? And so this sign got put up that says, the world's need. So many gods, so many creeds, so many paths that wind and wind, when just the art of being kind is all this sad world needs. It's a quote from Ellen Wheeler Wilcox, which is very nice. And then underneath that in large sign is keep church and state separate. Well, that's, you know, so far the sentiment is okay. But then they continue. At the season of the winter solstice, may reason prevail. Yes, a sentiment I think we can all agree with. They say there are no gods, no devils, no angels, no heaven or hell. There is only our natural world. Religion is but myth and superstition that hardens hearts and enslaves minds. And here's my problem with that. Up until those last six or eight words, I thought, this is fine. You know, people who want to believe in atheism, they should have a, you know, they should be able to celebrate the winter solstice too. You know, now there's all this hysteria in Washington State. You know, what about the people who want to slaughter goats, you know, and have sacrifices? are we going to allow them to slaughter goats on the holiday? You know, whatever. But, you know, it's not going to happen. But, you know, basically the state has said, as the result of these two lawsuits and this crazy, I mean, this all started with this Republican legislator who was doing the Bill O'Reilly War on Christmas thing. The state has said, you know, any religion that wants to pretty much can put a sign out here. But, of course, the atheist sign has got everybody all, it's got, you know, O'Reilly and all the Christians, so they've got their panties in a wad. And the one thing that was unfortunate, I think, in this, because, you know, atheism is a long and honorable tradition, and agnosticism as well, which I, you know, in my world of definitions, and I realize many of you disagree with this, it's fine, we can agree to disagree. Agnosticism is you know, what my dad was, for example. He says, you know, I have no idea what's out there. He says, in all probability, I figure when I die, the lights are going to go off. But I don't know. I don't have any proof one way or the other. That's an agnostic. I don't think that that's a religion. I think that's a rational position. But to say, I know there's nothing out there. I know there's no supernatural forces. I know that the idea of spirits hanging around is impossible. I know that it's impossible that, you know, fill in the blank, right? That somebody could, you know, feel the presence of God. I know that's all impossible. That's a religion because it's a statement of belief. So anyhow, the atheists have their statement of belief there. But then they say, but myth and superstition hardens hearts and enslaves minds. That, in my opinion, is like saying, is like if the Christians had put up a sign. I mean, the Christians have a creche, I think, this year. But they don't have a sign that says, you know, that repeats the old anti-Semitic myth that was used for so many years to justify literally killing Jews. You know, the Jews killed Jesus, when in fact it was the Romans. But, you know, they don't have a sign that, the Christians don't have a sign that, like, slurs another religion. Or the Muslims don't have a sign up that says, you know, everybody else is an infidel and should be put to death. Which, again, doesn't reflect the mainstream thought in Islam, but does reflect the thought of a few crazies. And, you know, and so on. So, you know, this thing of celebrating, you know, the world's need. So many gods, so many creeds, so many paths that wind and wind, when just the art of being kind is all this sad world needs. That's a beautiful sentiment. And keep state and church separate. That's a beautiful sentiment. At this season of the winter solstice, may reason prevail. Wonderful sentiment. Put it out there. But to say religion is but myth and superstition that hardens hearts and enslaves minds, well, yeah, sometimes that's true. But very often it's not. And besides that, it's a gratuitous slap. So, you know, I would say that the atheists who put the sign up, really just went one step too far for their own purposes. As I said, you know, atheism has a long and storied tradition and, you know, honorable and all that kind of thing. And it's a fine thing. But, you know, I think this is just pushing it. So that, yeah, my rant for Anything Goes Friday. We'll take your rants now. Bill in Kelso, Washington. Hey, Bill, what's up?
What a pleasure to speak with you, sir. You're probably the smartest. Yeah, you are the smartest man on the radio. And I also want to give a compliment to Marcus. He's a smart guy, too.
Our call screener, Marcus, is doing a great job today. And Stephanie running the board, she's doing a great job, too, especially under the weird circumstances of having, you know, randomly electronic things around the studio have just been blowing up. You know, I don't know. It's just been one of those weird days. Maybe static electricity in my feet or something.
I wouldn't put it past, you know, them trying to sabotage a smart guy.
No, I don't. You know, I think Alberto Gonzalez is retired to Texas, and Michael McCarthy is not smart enough to do it. So, anyhow, what'd you call about, Bill?
Well, I have about 4 or 5 points, but they're short.
Well, or pick one, because I got a whole bunch of people who want to get in here, and it's just not fair.
Here's the thing. If Obama wants to be, you know, the president of change, it would be in our best interest for him not to pardon George Bush, because we could then take him up on the murder thing. We could get him for the Valerie Plame, the lying us into war. And, I guess that probably is the whole thing.
No, absolutely. And I'm not expecting Obama to preemptively pardon Bush, and I absolutely agree with you. But first we have the investigation. I mean, you know, we all know, right? I mean, you got the Downing Street memos, Downing Street minutes, and I mean, there's so much evidence just laying around on the ground. The pardons that you have to worry about, though, are not those coming out of Obama. The pardons that you have to worry about are the next, you know, 50-some-odd days coming out of Bush. But still, that should not stop the investigations. Jerry Ford made a terrible mistake when he pardoned Richard Nixon. The Democrats in the House and Senate made a worse mistake when they decided not to continue the investigations into Watergate. Ronald Reagan made a terrible mistake, or committed a crime against democracy, I guess, you know, small c, when he pardoned Caspar Weinberger and all the other guys, and, you know, Ollie North, the guys involved with Iran-Contra. The Democrats in Congress made a much larger mistake when they said, we're not going to investigate this. We're not going to push this any farther. So, you know, Bush, I guarantee you, he's going to be issuing pardons and he's going to be giving get-out-of-jail-free passes to his buddies. Congress damn well better not investigate.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Attitude toward religion. Bill O'Reilly has just gone nuts on this. I'm telling you, this is so sad. This is here's Bill O'Reilly going off on this thing. I think. Yeah, we can't get the audio out of the computer. That's all right. Anyhow, what he's doing is he's giving out Christine Gregoire's phone number, right? The governor of the state of Washington. So I just asked Stephanie, can you Google around and see if you can find Bill O'Reilly's office phone number? We'll pass that. It's tit for tat. It's small stuff. Okay, Matt in Olalla, Washington. Speaking of Washington, hey Matt, what's up?
Hey, first thing, I listen to you almost every day. You happen to be right in time for my commute to work. Anyway, I'm calling about what you just said, that atheism was a religion, and I take a little bit of offense to that. I've been an atheist for a good half my life, and it's like calling bald a hair color. I'm a member of online atheist forums, and I have many atheist friends. And
do you think people choose to be bald, Matt?
Say again?
Do you think people choose to be bald?
In some cases, yes.
Well, then they're not bald. They're simply shaven.
Okay, fair enough. Well, the analogy I may not hold water, but I still think... Well, fair enough. But what I would say is, in my limited experience, it's anecdotal, I admit it, but a strong minority of atheists will say that they are absolutely certain that there isn't a God. What they will say is, I doubt it, for the same reason that I doubt the existence of a Loch Ness Monster or Sasquatch.
Yeah, then they're not atheists, they're agnostics.
By definition, atheism means not theism.
Well,
it doesn't mean that you are certain that something doesn't exist. It simply means,
you know, in the dictionary sense, you're right. But when somebody comes up to me and says, "I know that there is nothing out there. I know it." That's a positive assertion, not a negative assertion. And,
I agree.
And that is a religious statement. If somebody says, "I don't know. I have no religion. I don't know. Maybe it's there, maybe it's not. I got nothing." That's why I'm drawing this distinction, and I realize the dictionary doesn't always, there's different dictionaries, and I get all the quotes, and I'll get all the email from everybody all over again. Every time I bring it up, I know. But nonetheless, my assertion here, Matt, is that if you are stating as an absolute fact, or even as a statement of personal belief, that there's nothing, that Native Americans who had sacred burial sites and thought there were ghosts there or whatever, spirits there, or who thought that particular rivers or trees had particular qualities that can't be quantified by science, that none of that stuff is real. That, the possibility of talking to the dead, the possibility of angels or demons, none of that, you're absolutely certain that none of that is possible, then I would say that is a statement of religion, because it's a statement of belief.
And you know what, Tom? I agree with you 100%. The only thing that I would add is that people that believe that strongly are a small minority of the atheist community. I don't have numbers or polls to show that, but in my entire lifetime of talking and living with atheists, that's a small minority of people that say they are certain.
Yeah. Well, and frankly, it's a problematic issue, because what happens is the evangelical atheists are, I think, frankly, creating a problem for the rational atheists, the people that I refer to as agnostics, who simply say, I don't know. I mean, I grew up in a household where my mother was, very religious, and my father was agnostic. And I came to my own opinions of things. And I consider myself spiritual and not religious. So there it gets even weirder. But the point is that when people say, I have certainty about this. And by the way, your religion is causing you to be crazy. Then that kind of evangelism is something that I don't think is useful for the cause of atheism. And that was my whole point about this thing in Washington State. I thought the sign was wonderful up until the last six or eight words. And if those last six or eight words hadn't been there, it would have been a positive contribution. But why slap somebody else's belief?
Fair enough.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I would say that I do believe that religion doesn't help near as much as it hurts. But I agree that making that kind of a statement in the holidays, I do think it's simply to cause trouble and upset
people, and
I think that does cause a bad representation of atheism.
Thank you, Matt. And I would be the first to acknowledge, the Crusades, all the horrible things that have been done in the name of religion. But on the other hand, Alexander the Great was not conquering on behalf of a religion. Attila the Hun was not conquering on behalf. There's been plenty of murder and death and pillaging that has been done. The Romans had their gods, but they weren't out to evangelize the world. The Roman Empire and all the damage that they did, there's been plenty of damage done in the world in the name of simply, hey, let's get ours. Let's steal from the Aboriginal, the indigenous people, from the native people. Zach in Portland. Hey, Zach.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
I just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about when you said that people come to you and say that they know there is no God, and that's just a different definition of what no means. It's no in a conventional, a useful sense. In every other place except for religion, you can say you know something, and there's a certain criteria you use to say you know it. And atheists just apply that same criteria they use for that everyone else uses for everything else but religion to religion. I can say I know there is no God by applying everyday criteria to it.
I think we're splitting hairs here, Zach. Do you know? Well, no, that's a lousy example. I was going to say electricity. Do you know how electricity works?
Yeah, exactly. I know. I have plenty of evidence to, and I can go research and I can look up, and I say I know electricity exists and it's useful. And I say I know there is no God in that sense. In every other sense, you would use the word no.
Yeah. So you are positively asserting a negative.
Well, I'm saying in a convention. I'm using.
Do you know, for example, that there's no such thing as ESP?
Yeah, I can say I know there's no such thing as ESP. There's never been.
Okay. If you and I had been alive 200 years ago, would you have said there's no such possibility as radio waves or television waves?
That would have been fine for me to say. There was no evidence at the time to even propose that there were radio waves. There was no reason for me to think there was. So I could say I know there is.
But yes, you would have been wrong.
See,
that's the problem. Okay, Zach, a good conversation. Thank you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
TomHartman.com for our live free chat room. AirAmerica.com for our live free web video. Hi there, guys. And 866-303-2270, our toll-free number from all across the United States. It's Anything Goes Friday. And Charles in Georgetown, Kentucky. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
I just had a thought, and just thinking in terms of confessions of an economic hitman and the vast amount of money.
My old friend John Perkins.
Yes, sir. And with that in mind, and the vast amounts of money that we now owe China, I have to wonder if some of what's going on right now, if there's some type of a tie-in, and how much leverage China may be applying to our national leaders right now. Because that's the only thing that makes sense.
A lot. You know, Paulson left for China yesterday. There was a whole article about it in the Financial Times about how he's going hat in hand, begging them not to change the value of their currency, what I knew as the yuan when I was in China, the renminbi or however they said, not to change the value of their currency relative to the dollar because, we're concerned that the only kind of trade policy that we have in the United States is keeping the dollar weak and other currencies strong or vice versa in order to boost or reduce imports or exports. And it's just it's a stupid way to have a trade policy, but it's about all we've got. And now this was in, I believe, this morning's Financial Times, an article about how the Chinese are saying that at the federal level, at the national level, the sovereign wealth fund that they've got, which has got a couple of $1 trillion in it, which is very heavily invested in U.S. government securities. They've got all these dollars. They've got to put them somewhere, that they're going to stop buying stock in U.S. financial institutions, no more banks and things. And this has got Paulson and all these guys terrified, too. So, yeah, the Chinese, and wait until the Chinese decide that they want to take out Taiwan. Just wait. I mean, keep in mind, China is the only country in the last decade and a half that has actually had a senior military official, threaten us with a nuclear weapon and not lose his job. So, yeah. Elliot in Northampton, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Elliot, what's on your mind today?
Well, thank you for taking my call, Tom. I was listening to your conversation about atheism. I just kind of came in at the end, but I think it's an incredibly relevant conversation and necessary to our times. I just wanted to throw in a couple of perspectives. Number one, an analogy that you might want to use in terms of God and not having empirical evidence. It was Descartes that said all that we can determine empirically about the brain we call brain. And what we can't determine empirically, we call mind. So therefore, we cannot prove that there is such a thing as the mind. And that might be an analogy. But the point, I wanted to make a point about atheists that I've listened to and have talked to. They all seem to have the same thing in common, which is they seem to be in reaction against the biblical Christian or Jewish God.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never talked to, maybe it might be cultural, but I've never talked to any that are in reaction against, say, Krishna or whatever.
Yeah.
And in that case, it seems as though they use science or whatever to interrupt their philosophical journey, which is a natural philosophical journey that is meant to continue. And you could say that if they were to investigate other deities, they might, you know, if they went to India, they might be overcome by some divine force.
Well,
they might not.
Elliot, I would submit to you that there's two things going on here. Number one, you've got some people who have been wounded by religion. They've been wounded by the way that they were brought up, and they're being reactive. It's just pure reaction.
That's what I'm saying.
There are other people, and these are the evangelical ones, and I see this among evangelical Christians. I've seen it among evangelical Hindus. I've seen it among, Buddhism isn't so much an evangelical religion, and Judaism, by and large, outside of perhaps the Lubavitchers, but that's even within Judaism. Judaism is by and large not an evangelical religion. But among the people who are the most evangelical for their particular point of view, including the evangelical atheists, my belief is, and this is just purely my opinion, so I'll just lay that out as that, is that they are unsure of what they believe. And so they're looking for validation in that. And if I can convince you of what my personal belief is, that, you know, Krishna was the son of God, or Jesus was, or that, you know, Moses parted the Red Sea, or that there's nothing out there and that the world just goes dark when we die. If I can convince you of that, then it helps soften my own internal doubt about it. It validates for me that maybe I'm right. And so in my experience in all my years in on this world, it has always seemed to me that the people who were most evangelical, pretty much about, you know, anything that was in the realm of religion, were the ones who were the least certain about their own sense of it. And that the evangelism was a symptom. And certainly I've seen this with the Seventh-day Adventists and Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons as well, who I've encountered in my life, that they're not totally certain about it. And that's why they've got to convince. If I can just convince 40 or 50 people, that'll prove to me that I was right.
Mm-hmm.
And so
can I make a point about the issue, though, at hand, which was the sign, I think,
yeah.
And the statement about religion being a source of fanaticism and violence.
Well, the statement is religion is but myth and superstition that hardens hearts and enslaves minds.
Yeah, I think that those who are religious really have to own that and deal with that aspect of
religion. No, you're absolutely right. And that's where, you know, Christianity and Islam in particular, from Tim McVeigh blowing up the Oklahoma City building in the name of Jesus because he thought it was going to, bring about a Christian Reformation in America and do away with all the people who are not Christians in America, to Osama bin Laden, arguably, assuming for a moment the official storyline, blowing up the Twin Towers because of, Islam. I mean, there are toxic elements within these religions, and we do have to acknowledge those, and we do have to, frankly, I think, help heal those people. Gail in Salem, Virginia, you would like to speak to this topic.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Gail.
I am an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
I have and I'm also an American. That mm-hmm. right there. And so in our country, we say that we have freedom of religion.
Right.
Now, that also means freedom from religion. Consequently, I believe that all of the things that I accept as true and are rational to me, and therefore I am an atheist, is right for me.
Yeah. Let me just challenge you on one statement. You said you have a freedom from religion. We have a constitutional freedom from our government imposing religion
right.
on us. But I would submit to you that if a merchant wants to have you know, Merry Christmas stuff out in front of their store as a way of increasing sales, that's no different than the same merchant, you know, running an ad with, you know, a smiling little kid on it to promote sales, you know, during the summer, or, you know, the Bennington ads with, or any ads. I mean, you know, different races as a way of selling things, or Nike using athletes. I mean, it's all just promotion.
Well, that's true. And
so we don't have a right to a freedom from religion being in our world around us any more than we have a right to there being not commercial things in the world around us.
No, I think what you're misunderstanding what I'm saying.
Okay.
My right to freedom from religion means that you don't have a right to force me to believe the way you do.
Right.
That's my right of freedom from religion.
Yep.
For those who are whatever church or whatever religion they want to belong to, that's their business.
Yep.
And I afford them that right. If somebody puts up a Christmas tree, gee, I put up a Christmas tree. It's pagan. Okay?
Yep.
It's traditional as opposed to meaning anything.
Yeah, well, that was my point where I began this rant, is that the Christmas tree started probably 10, 20,000 years ago in Europe where, you know, at the shortest day of the year, the shaman would go up and light a giant tree and say, I'll bring the sun back. And every year they'd all say, he did it again.
Well, you know, years ago when my children were little, I have the album Hair, okay?
Mm.
And in it there's a song where he says, I believe in God and God believes in Claude, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
I would sing it along, and my son, who was very young then, would say, why do you sing that song? You don't believe in God. I said, it doesn't make any difference. It's a song. It doesn't mean anything.
There you go. Okay, Gail, you're a rational atheist. Thank you very much for the call and for listening to us there in Virginia. We got to take a break here. It is 16 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, for our live chat room. Free live. Yeah, cool. Interesting conversation in there as well. Well, we don't put up a Christmas tree. It's too much work, AJ says. Well, that's a good reason, too, I suppose. Right? No, it's not? Okay.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
So now he tells us, the headline over the Huffington Post, George Bush acknowledges for the first time a recession. O.J. Simpson sentenced to at least 15 years. After being convicted in civil court of murdering his wife, I guess, you know, karma does catch up with you. O'Reilly ambushes a New Yorker writer. Yeah, right. Al Franken, up 22 votes now. He's finding some more votes. And we'll see what's going on with the Supreme Court. And this, we'll catch the update on this with the Talk Radio News Service at the end of the hour. But this wacky lawsuit that, you know, Barack Obama is not a natural born citizen. Well, what does that mean? First of all, apparently he is. He was born in Hawaii, and the Hawaiians say they have the birth certificate, the original, but they're not going to pass it out because there's these confidentiality laws. So. Anyhow, strange stuff going on. Anna in Greeley, Colorado. Hey, Anna, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Well, I thought the last two callers had really good comments on this religion thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a person who doesn't believe it necessary to postulate the existence of a supreme being.
Mm-hmm.
However, I never bother others with this.
Well, and you're like my dad. I lived with him for almost 30 years before I knew that he felt that way. You know?
I've talked to people about, of course, because, you know, God wants us to kill everybody. But anyway, that kind of thing I talk about.
Yeah.
I mean, to people, why is this? And the reason I do is because I grew up in Jim Crow era. And the Jim Crow, the Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal doctrine was brought on by Louisiana apartheid law. And you know how strong that was. And people who black people could not come into the church. And I began to really suspect things right then.
Yeah.
Why is this? You know, what's going on with that? And I know since then, over 73 years, that it is that of course, the Catholic Church built Europe, and it brought in racism and sexism. And so that's part of our Western culture. And it needs to be looked at. There's no question about it. But I'm not the one to tell them to look at it.
Yeah.
I mean, they need to find that within themselves to say, okay, let's find out why we're doing, you know, what this is about.
No, I got it, Anna, and I think you've said it very well. And I thank you for calling and sharing it. It's, you know, it's you've got it figured out for you, and I honor that. I absolutely honor that. I think that that's a marvelous thing. Mike, and you don't feel the need to convince anybody else. And that convinces me that you actually have it figured out for you. Mike in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Mike.
Hi. Well, I was going to get off the religion thing and go back on the GM.
That's fine. You know, anything goes Friday. Anything you want to talk about.
Motor company bailouts. And I do want to emphasize their bailout. It's not really a loan because the government, you know, is backing up those so-called loans. So if they default on them,
they're uncollateralized, essentially.
Right. We're basically loaning them probably more money than they're even worth at this point.
Yeah. Well, then the market value of both GM and Ford is $3 billion combined.
Right. So we're going to lend them $28 or $30 billion.
But you can say the same thing about the banks, by the way. Their market value is way below the amount of money we're getting.
Oh, absolutely. And I was against the bank bailout, too.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, to segue there, didn't we lend the banks $700 billion so that they would ease credit? Why aren't they lending money to the motor companies? Why didn't we make them, you know, lend money, the money that we pretty much gave them?
Yeah. That's an excellent question. I mean, and the answer is that what we've got is an old boy network. We've got basically a criminal enterprise operating out of the White House right now with the complicity of both parties and a whole bunch of lobbyists. And you know, it's just so wrong. We need to nationalize the Fed. We need to buy the Federal Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve, from its private stockholders and put it under the aegis of the Treasury Department and say, okay, we're gonna, as a nation, we're gonna take control of our own currency finally and have some responsible use of that. We need to raise taxes to the point where we no longer are generating huge deficits and we can start paying down all the money that Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. and in the first couple of years of Bill Clinton's administration, although he gets, in my opinion, a huge pass on this, he did good. And certainly George W. Bush, the most profligate of all of them, that these guys squandered these, you know, $9 to $11 trillion just to try to make the economy look good when in fact it was, you know, it's like putting wallpaper over rotted sheetrock, you know, and $11 trillion wallpaper at that. And now the bill is coming due, and we're going to have to pay that bill, and we're going to have to change our trade policies, and we're going to have to change the way that we do business in this country. And guess what? Some of these guys have walked away with billions, hundreds of billions, certainly millions. They're going to have to pay their piece of, you know.
Well, they're still trying to take more billions.
Oh, I know. It's an ongoing
problem.
Yeah, I agree with you, Michael, and very well said. It's like what they're doing right now, what the Bush White, this is disaster capitalism. This is, Naomi Klein nailed this so spot on. This is exactly the same thing that happened in Iraq. They are leaving the White House, and they're not just stealing the china and the silver. They're taking the friggin' furniture along with them. They're ripping up the carpets.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Okay, here's the update as of 2 minutes ago. O.J. Simpson sentenced to at least 9 years in prison, according to the New York Times. The Supreme Court is going to rule on whether the president can order indefinite military detention of people living in the United States. That would be you and me. Wait a minute, the Supreme Court has to rule on this? Whether the government can come to you, Ron Hartenbaum, and say, you know, we're going to put you in prison for the rest of your life and not even charge you with a crime.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah. You got to get over here and wave to the camera, you know. Ron is our designated punching bag here today. The jobless rate, 6.7% as the economy shrinks. The real unemployment rate is somewhere between 11 and 14%. You consider people who are unemployed but no longer drawing unemployment compensation or have given up looking. And Nick Kristof in New York Times today says, a model ex-president, Jimmy Carter's efforts to eradicate a tropical parasite should set an example for future former presidents. Well, gee, what future former president might there be? Can you think of anybody who's going to become a former president soon? Do you think he'll have any interest in eradicating parasites in the third world? I think what George W. has said is he's looking forward to going back to Texas. And I have a feeling he's going to go back to drinking. In fact, I have a feeling he already has. But anyway, that's just what the National Enquirer tells me. And, of course, as the Republicans will tell you, they're always right. Yeah. National Enquirer. You know, when they were all over John Edwards, the Republicans were all out there. Michelle Malkin, the whole bunch of them. Yeah, the National Enquirer, they've never been wrong. They've only been sued once, and that was by Carol Burnett. And she only won on a technicality. They check their facts. They get things right. Well, National Enquirer has got some things to say about Sarah Palin having an affair with her husband's business partner. Says that George and Laura haven't been sleeping together for years, that he's been drinking again. I mean, serious stuff. You got to read the National Enquirer. It's important. Well, at least according to the Republican Party. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. Tim in South Bend, Indiana. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I got something I think that'll make you want to drink.
Okay.
I have a brother that works with the auto industry as a supplier of sorts. I don't want to say specifically, but he does work with Toyota, GM, and Ford. And he told me that the GM plant in Fort Wayne, even as little as a couple of weeks ago, their workers were working overtime at the truck plant. Now, why in God's name would they be working overtime to try to push trucks through if there's people aren't buying their trucks?
Well, I may be wrong on this, but somebody is making all those vehicles that they're using in Iraq. I mean, the U.S. military is buying a lot of vehicles. And so it's not inconceivable that there is some vehicle that is being used as, you know, as a modified Hummer or Humvee or something. But, I mean, that's the only thing that comes to mind that would be moderately rational. I don't know, Tim.
Well, he even turned to him and said, you know, that he thought maybe they were trying to put him on the lot so they could say, look, see how bad things are?
Yeah, well, if they're working overtime and they're paying overtime to do that, maybe it's a strategy that'll work. I mean, look at what the banks did.
Yeah.
Hey, look how bankrupt we are. We just, you know, we bet on $500 trillion worth of derivatives, and now we got nothing. Hey, put some across our palms with cash. It's a possibility. Tim, thanks for the heads up. If you get any details on that, pass them along. You know, my email address is on our website over at tomhartman.com. I actually do read my email, although I don't respond to most just because there's just not enough time. I get 500-600 a day, but I do read them all. Jimmy in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jimmy, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing, man? I'm a big fan of your show. I listen to you every day.
Thank you.
Religiously,
I say. Apropos of today's many topics, yeah. So what's up, Jimmy?
No, it's about the bailout. I mean, or the loan, I'm sorry, quote-unquote loan, and they're giving these three big car manufacturers.
Yeah.
I mean, I keep telling friends of mine, you know, I'm a real estate investor here in Miami, and I actually survived this whole monsoon of, you know, foreclosures.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is this. I mean, what good is giving any of these people money when the banks are not lending anything? The banks right now are so restrictive on loans for homes.
Yeah.
And also loans on cars. I mean, I went to the car dealership, And they have the same programs available, 60 months or 72 months,
mm-hmm.
The 8%, 10%. It's like they're not coming up with anything.
Yeah, and it's going to get worse. And credit card debt, credit cards, they're going to start cutting back on people's credit card limits. And people are going to discover that when they got those little things in the mail that they didn't bother to read, where that say, by the way, the fine print has changed. The fine print has changed to say, you think you've got a $7,000 line of credit on your MasterCard. We're just, and you've got $6,500 charged on your card. We just made your limit $4,000. And if you don't pay it down to $4,000, we're going to start hitting you with huge penalties and fines. That's what they're going to start doing.
Yeah, it's already happening with a line of credit that a friend of mine had from a bank that already went bankrupt, and the FDIC is taking over.
Yeah,
and they said we're gonna cut your line of credit down, where you can't borrow anymore, you know, from your line of credit.
Right.
So it's already happening. But my I think that the economy is in far worse situation than a lot of people are thinking.
It is.
Because when you think about it, if you want to finance anything, the first thing that they're going to do is pull your credit. Everybody right now, I mean, the majority of people in Miami especially, have horrific credit.
Yeah.
Who's going to lend them anything?
There's a lot of people in trouble, Jimmy. You're absolutely right, and thanks for the call and for pointing it out. Here's the good news. The good news is during the Great Depression, when things were a hell of a lot worse than they are right now, some of the best businesses in America were started. During the Great Depression, when things were a lot worse than they are now, at least two-thirds, and arguably a few more, of the people in America were employed right through the whole thing. That if that economic downturns, I've started businesses in the 70s and in the 80s. Every coincidentally, Louise and I were just looking back over this the other day. Three of the businesses that we started that are still around and are still successful, we started in the depths of recessions where everybody was hysterical. They're wonderful opportunities, entrepreneurial times. Recessions are great entrepreneurial times. There's a world of opportunity out there. And this is the time when the wheat gets separated from the chaff. This is the time when you can step out and you can show the qualities that you have. You can bring the energy to the table. You can come up with new ideas. You can develop new markets. I'm telling you, it is. We have very hard times, very difficult times. These are also times of opportunity right across the board. And I don't mean predatory opportunity. I'm not talking about, oh, gee, you can buy land, you can buy, you know, foreclosed houses, you know, that kind of cheesy stuff that they sell on TV where, you know, $15.95 show up to the seminar. Not that kind of thing. I'm talking about real opportunity. Bill in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Tom. I just had a quick question for you. I've listened to you for a long time, and I've heard you speak about Christianity and that you identify yourself as a Christian. And I've never heard a really clear definition in your terms of Christianity and even broader terms that you've used today, like spirituality or mm-hmm. or even the term God. And I was wondering if you could take a little time to kind of define those terms. I personally identify with your father's perspective,
mm-hmm.
but I would really appreciate it if you would kind of elaborate a little bit. That's all I'm actually doing is I identify with your politics also, by the way.
Okay.
But I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
I'm not going to. Because, you know, my spiritual life has been, you know, very complex over a lot of years, and I've plugged into a whole variety of things from I realize that there's this spiritual deli thing that is easy to be dismissive of, but I think that many people who have spent a lot of their life looking for some sort of making sense of it or some ultimate truth or whatever have been through a lot of things. And I mean from fundamentalist Christianity to parts and pieces of Judaism. The first language I ever spoke was Yiddish, although I don't want to get into that whole thing, but in any case, Hinduism, I mean, you know, I took TM initiation when I was 16. I was in SRF, Self-Realization Fellowship, Yogananda's group. I took refuge from the Dalai Lama, so I think legally or technically I'm a Buddhist. You can see the video of it on the web, the Dalai Lama movie people, narrated with Harrison Ford, just put up the video of me and the Dalai Lama last week. Broadly, what I would like Christianity to be, or Christians to be defined as, is people who live their lives by the precepts that Jesus talked about. And I think that there's way too little of that. And just to speak to my sense of spirituality and what it is I've been trying to make sense out of all these years, when I was 7 years old, I was our local church, the Kennan Drive Church of the Nazarene, had this summer thing where you could go out with this farm family and just hang out in a farm because we lived in the city in Lansing. And I was sitting with this, and a bunch of the kids had gone off playing, and I'm sitting with this old farmer with a card table between us on the lawn of his farm. It's the summer. It's in Michigan. Beautiful summer day on the lawn of this big old farmhouse with some lemonade. And we're just sitting there and talking. And he says, look out there at the sky. Isn't that incredible? And I'm looking at the sky. Here's this blue sky with these clouds in it floating along. He says, see how blue it is? And I'm like, yeah. He says, you feel the wind on your face? I'm like, yeah. He says, you see the trees there, that long stretch of trees along the road that runs along the side of the cornfield? Yeah, I see those. He says, you see the cornfield? Yeah. See the cars driving along? Uh-huh. See the lawn here, this green lawn, and the houses and the buildings? Yeah. So look in the, you can, don't look at the sun, but you can see the kind of the suns out there. I'm like, yeah. And then he leans over, and in this very conspiratorial voice, like he's giving me this great secret, he says, it's all alive. And I just got it right down to the bottom of my feet that it's all alive. It was that moment of, oh my God. And that's religion for me.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Hey, thanks to Marcus and Stephanie and Ron and all my friend Ron here, to Louise and Sean and Sue and Mike Toth, and thanks to all the folks who helped make this show possible. It is not a singular effort. This show is a collaborative effort of a whole bunch of really fine people, including a whole bunch of really fine radio stations. Thank you so much to our affiliates for having us on your air. And to our sponsors, thank you so much for making this show possible. And most importantly, thank you to you, our listeners, for listening to the program, for letting our sponsors know that you're listening, for letting our radio stations know that you like the show, and for being Americans who care about this country and humans who care about this world. Steve in San Luis Obispo. Hey, Steve, listening on KYNS. What's up?
How you doing? I usually agree with almost everything you say.
But?
And I listen regularly. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
But when it comes to evangelical atheism, I'm an atheist who never did feel the need to cram it down people's throats, but I won't believe anything that there's no evidence to back up. So I won't believe the official story of 9/11 either. But in these times when things are so urgent, like climate change and overpopulation, there's so many issues that the religious people seem to come down on the wrong side of, and we really need their contribution to solve these problems. And if you think that the afterlife is where it's at, maybe you're not going to be saving this planet.
Yeah. No, Steve, that is one of the problems that I think that we have with a lot of religions that say that you should conduct yourself entirely in this life so that you will entirely be rewarded in the next. And frankly, I think a good and honest and clear-eyed reading of the sacred texts of all the world's great religions indicates that that's really not what their founders had in mind. Bob Ney is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Bob, how are you?
How are you doing?
Just great. It was nice seeing you a couple of days ago, Tuesday, I guess it was, at Liz Claiborne.
It was great.
Yeah, it was very, very nice.
Good cause, and you all participate, and that's wonderful.
Yeah, and you're doing a great job with the Talk Radio News Service these days. What's up in the world? What's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, there's a lot. It's not in session except for the House committee. Of course, there's a hearing today. The big three automaker CEOs were there along with representatives of the union. And there was a lot of questions asked, and I think a lot of good comments came out, especially Congressman Elijah Cummings and, of course, Chairman Frank. And I think they had some good legitimate points. You know, decided today.
I'm curious about your take on this. You're a former member of Congress, and so you have a particular insight into this. Barney Frank made the comment today, and I'm having to paraphrase this from memory. I just shut my computer down because I'm running out of town here as soon as I get off the air. But he made the comment, something to the effect of, Barack Obama has said we have only one president at a time. And in saying that, he may be overestimating how many presidents we have right now. You know, which is kind of a joking way of saying George Bush is not behaving like a president. He's not dealing with the real issues and crises that are in front of us. And frankly, neither is his party. And therefore, Obama should take a stronger leadership role, even though the guy doesn't actually have any legal office to take that role from. What are your thoughts on that, Bob?
Well, right now, Barack Obama, he's got the power of the bully pulpit come January, but right now it's really not in his lap. He can't tell Paulson what to do. I know what Congressman Frank's saying. He's saying, look, Bush is not doing anything. It's going to be up to Barack Obama to start to weigh in on some things. And Obama's transition team is really doing that type of thing. But what I think the frustration Barney Frank has, and I would have if I was there, President Bush comes out today and he might as well not even have done a press conference. We have a recession, duh. Speaker Pelosi came out and gave the statistics. 533,000 jobs were lost in November. President Bush came out and said, that's kind of a sad thing. I'm concerned about taxpayers' money, blah, blah, blah. So, Paulson has made it now difficult. He came to Congress, and if I was a member of Congress sitting there listening to what Paulson said and he turned around and did whatever he pleased, no wonder everybody's having a rough time now when it comes to the automobile side of it.
Right.
I think that it's a frustration, I think, by Chairman Frank.
Well, and isn't there also a potential landmine here? If Barack Obama were to step out onto that ledge of using a bully pulpit that is not legally his, but certainly is morally and politically his right now, and start asserting political positions, policy positions, and trying to push Congress in a particular way as if he was president, and then Congress pushes back, he would have his first experience of failure before he's even president, because you've got a Congress right now with enough Republicans in the Senate that they can blow up anything.
Oh, that's correct. And also, Paulson does not, Paulson did not tell the truth to Congress. Who thinks that he would tell the truth to Barack Obama?
Right.
So Paulson doesn't work for him. This would be a no-starter for Barack Obama. Frankly, he's doing exactly 150% of what he should be doing. He's putting a team together quickly. He's addressing issues. He's gearing up, ready to go day one. But to enter this now, he can't. Look, Bush has failed. He's out of the loop. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution for United States to leave. What does Bush's people say? Well, we're going to read it in English. We may not agree. What does he not understand about leave? So he's not paying attention, and, there's nothing. I hate to say it. Right now, there's nothing to be done about him.
Yeah.
We just got to wait till he leaves.
Yeah, and hold our breath and, say a few prayers.
That's right.
Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Bob, you're one of the people I'm thankful for, too. Thank you so much for being
here.
Thank you, sir. Good talking with you.
You, too.
And Monday, we'll be talking with Yaron Brook. Should we worry about the fact that a toys made in China might kill us? He says, don't worry, be happy. Should be an interesting conversation. Have a great weekend. And don't forget, please don't ever forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it! Have a great one. We'll see you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.